have this thing in Ontario or Toronto, I don't know what it is, that lawyers have to update a certain amount of, if they get a certain amount of credits, even if they've been a lawyer for like 30 years or something.
Yeah,
if they take courses.
Yeah.
I don't know if they have that in the States.
Yeah, sure.
So my father was telling me that they, so this a bunch of film lawyers got together and they got credited and they learned how to get the thing. Someone gives them a shear. And I think that he compares it to the secular law and things.
Yeah, well, that's what they do. That's a big thing. It's a Chabad runs many programs like that.
Oh, yeah. This is like, I thought this was this guy's Chiddush.
No. I myself have
given these things.
Done this many, many times. Even for Semitic, we've done it.
Oh, yeah, and get these law credits.
They arrange things. You go to New York and do a continuing legal. That's the big draw. I mean, if you want to attract, let's say you're giving you're giving a Torah shear. And you want to attract a lot of lawyers who are not yet from. But if they get credit, they'll come. But it's a big, it's not so easy. I mean, you have to get it clear. It's not so much. It's not like anything, you know, you want to give a share on that. You know, they have to, you know, the committee, there's a bar committee that looks at it, and they have to paskin on it. You know, so it can't be, you know, if you want to, I mean, you could pack, if you're smart enough, you can package anything, but it's not,
it's not so simple.
Some have to give you a hard time. So for example, you have to be knowledgeable in law. So if I give a talk like that, I can't just do halacha. I have to bring in
if they compare
secular law and compare it.
Right. Well, like the shiurim the Rav gave us with
just the kind of thing you hear here is suitable for that.
Right.
Yes. Hi. Did you want to ask? Him?
Yeah. What was it? I can come about later.
I'm just waiting for some more.
If somebody gives you money but has told you not to give maaser from it, like my dad's given me some money to get like shirts and stuff dry cleaned, and in the past when he gives me money he says like, you know, that's not your money to give charity out of it. When you have your own money you can do that. Am I obligated
if,
to do
if
it?
He specifically says you can only use the money, if he says it's your money but you can't use it for maaser, then you don't listen to him. But if he says this money can only be used for cleaning your shirts. You can't use it.
Can I show you the wording of the email and then you can see?
Yeah.
It says, I'll send you £200 per month, but it is only to be used for shirt cleaning, so you don't wear a shirt twice, and suits, press and dry clean, and toiletries and any other general requirements you have each month.
In the past, he's told you what?
He's told me not to give to give money out of that, the money that he gives me.
Does he follow up in this? I mean,
he wouldn't. If I didn't mention it to him, he wouldn't say anything.
I think you should. In other words,
yeah.
The only time you don't give is when he says it can only be used for like one.
Okay.
But if you can use the money for any of your expenses, but he just says not for tzedakah, so it is your money, then it becomes your money.
Because I'm 99% sure if I was to ask him, he would say no, just give it anyway. Not ask him, or?
No, don't ask him. No.
Okay. All right, thanks, Robert.
And he's not going to follow up on this. He's not going to ask you.
I don't think he
would. Okay,
yeah.
Just say it. Okay.
Right, just one more thing quickly.
Yeah.
Is the commandment of wearing tzitzit, is that rabbinic or derisive? We're just having a thing today. Like, is it an aveira not to wear them? Like,
It's an aveira to wear a four-cornered garment and not have a tzitzis.
But is it not?
But if you're not wearing the rabbinic, if you're not wearing the four-cornered garment, actually, it's not even rabbinic. It's a minog of Klal Yisrael. But you know, you're not transgressing a rabbinic law either.
So it's just a strong minog, basically.
It's a strong minog that Klal Yisrael was makabel.
All right. Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay, hi everybody. Again, I'm sorry we're going late today, but I guess you have a late share normally this time. Now I can gauge if the sleep ratio is higher in the second share. How late does this go?
10:25.
Okay.
Usually from like an hour after we start.
All right. Well, we'll see. Okay, maybe we won't go that long today. Okay. So anyway. Today I'm going to switch topics totally. We did talk about some of this a long time ago, but not the arichas. That is, I'm going to go back to some medical ethics issues that are very, very important for you to know. Not so much if you're going to be in Kiruv. You may not get so many questions in college Kiruv. But if you're going to be in Rabbanus, these will be very important questions. That is, the treatment of people who are elderly and terminally ill, meaning they have a condition in which in all probability they're going to die very soon. And the question is, how aggressive must we be to keep people alive and all sorts of mechanics, life support, and the like. It is very important because, you know, on one hand, modern medicine has created a scenario where people live longer. But because they live longer, they then get very weak and they develop different conditions. And we have the capacity that the Eberster gave us through machines and all sorts of other things to keep people alive, but sometimes in a very debilitated state, you know, in a coma or not really functioning. And the question is the Torah mechayev us to be ma'arech chayim under every and all circumstances? So you have to understand the following. Here you need to know what the secular law basically says, and this is true in America, it's true in Israel. So basically the secular law is very much the same. England is much the same. Yeah, almost all of the industrialized countries are going to be the same in this. And that is, let me give you a little background. So first I'm going to talk about the secular concepts for a while, then we'll move into the halacha. It used to be said that the purpose of medicine was to cure people and to extend their lives if that was possible. And as a result, the orientation of the medical community was do whatever you can to keep patients alive. Now, that began to change in the 1970s. And there's a very, very famous case that kind of changed the direction of the medical profession. And this was the case involving a young woman, Karen Quinlan. Karen Quinlan came from a very religious Catholic family. And she was in an automobile accident. And she was being maintained on life support respirators, you know, machines that did the breathing for her and the like. And her parents went to court to discontinue life support. The doctors wanted to keep her alive no matter what. And that's exactly right. That's exactly right. The cases, you'll see in a moment, the cases are the opposite. In the 1970s, it was the doctors that were fighting to keep her alive. Her parents said she would not want to be alive in that condition, and Anan Sahadeh, even though she didn't leave any document or anything, but Anan Sahadeh, that she wouldn't want to live in a permanent coma, and therefore, like Zochin Liharim Shlo Bafanav, we should have the right to discontinue life support. What happened was that the New Jersey Supreme Court did say that if there's clear evidence that she would not want to be alive this way, they actually allowed for the discontinuation of the respirator. Now, I want to point out again, Shlomo's observation is 1,000% correct. In those days, the doctors were fighting very, very aggressively to keep people alive. Now, by the middle of the 1980s, it's exactly the opposite. Doctors and hospitals were going to court to disconnect life support over the objections of families, sometimes even from people who wanted to keep patients alive. And ultimately, in many, many cases, courts did allow discontinuation of life support. It's a whole different orientation. Now, secular medical ethics is said to be based on four principles. And this is even called, the principles were formulated in Georgetown University. So this is called, which is a major center of...
When they formulated?
They were formulated probably in the 1980s. But they're like such a famous thing. It's called the Georgetown Mantra. Okay, Georgetown Mantra. These are the four principles of secular medical ethics. And they're very general. They don't have the precision of the yeshivish gedarim. I mean, it's very, very general stuff. But these are the general values. One thing you have to learn in the secular world, don't be medayik too much. It just doesn't work. The taichen is not there. I was margished at my first day of law school. You know, you read a judicial opinion and the judge kind of goes into chakiras and he goes into things. So I said, oh, this is good. I know this type of thing. But you see, when you start being Derish v'chayke, you know, it doesn't go there. It doesn't go. It sounds a little bit like a Gemara, like a Rishon, like an Achron, but it's only mamish skimming the surface. That's why yeshiva guys have trouble. They do good in law school by and large, but they have a little trouble because they try to make it deeper than it is. You know, you're kind of taking something that's not that deep, and you're trying to, you know, make it deep. So it's a, so you're overanalyzing. That's why also they don't do well on standardized multiple choice tests. The reason is because the multiple choice test, you know, if you think, I know, they give you a question, then they give you four possible answers. So a Ben Tyra like will see something wrong in every answer. This isn't right here. This isn't right here. You know, you can't be medayek. You have to have a shtickle geisha cup a little bit. don't be medayek so much. But okay. But anyway, so the Georgetown mantra is number one, beneficence. The doctor's job is to do what is good for the patient. Okay, again, that's not too much to find. The second principle is non-maleficence, which is just a fancy way of saying do no harm. But it's the third principle that's really the most important here. Non-maleficence, right? So beneficence is doing good. Non-maleficence is not doing bad. Do no harm, as they say. But the third principle is going to be very, very key here. The third principle is called autonomy. And autonomy means the patient is the absolute bialim over his body. And whatever the patient decides, or we could be medayek that he would want to decide, overrides everything else. So if the patient says he doesn't want chemotherapy, if the patient says he doesn't want a respirator, if the patient says ahead of time, if he's in a coma, he doesn't want to be put on life support, if the patient said if he goes into cardiac arrest, you know, a heart attack, he does not want CPR, the first two principles are canceled. Forget about beneficence, forget about not harming. Autonomy overrides everything. And that's very important. The underlying principle of secular medical ethics and the law is that the patient is kimat a total bialim to determine what should and what should not be done. Now the fourth principle is more of a social principle, distributive justice. That's going to legislatures, that when they determine how much money should be invested in medical treatments, they should consider all the needs of the population. Don't just put everything in taking care of the elderly. You have to, there's prenatal care. Okay, that's a separate thing. But what I want to focus on is I want to focus on the third principle, because that's really where the action is. Autonomy. Now, because under secular law, the patient is the balabas, we have a whole body of documents that federal law requires that every patient who goes into a hospital sign. And these documents go by different names. Sometimes they're called living wills. Sometimes they're called powers of attorney. Sometimes they're called health care proxies. But the tzad hashava, and sometimes they're called advanced directives. Now, all of these terms are slightly different. I'll give you the differences shortly. But the tzad hashava shebedavor is that the patient is supposed to indicate in a document ahead of time what he wants or doesn't want to be done. And he has the right to be chayzer on that document. He could always change his mind one way or the other, to either have more treatment or less treatment, but calls him on that he's not chozer. This document, I'm talking secular law here, this document is binding, it is obligatory on doctors, on hospitals, on nurses, on ambulances, on EMTs, like Hatzalah, emergency medical technicians. Okay, now, let me be more detailed. Again, the name is not that important, but these are different words. Advanced directives, we will call that the shame klali, meaning anything that the patient puts about how he wants to be treated is called an advanced directive. But the two types of advanced directives, and you can have one or the other or both, one is called a living will. Okay, so advanced directive is the shame klali. The shame klali is mispashet into two categories. A is living will. B is power of attorney or proxy. Those are exactly the same. Those are just different names. Healthcare proxy or power of attorney. Living will is a document where the person actually says what he wants to be done or what he doesn't want to be done. So a person might say in a living will, if I am in a coma, I do not want to be put on life support. If I go into cardiac arrest, I do not want CPR, or I want it. You can say, usually living wills are in the direction of what you don't want, but you can say what you want as well. I don't want to be given chemotherapy in the event of cancer and the like. That is a living will. A living will, and you can even be mice of things like you can harvest my organs, you can add something like that as well. So a living will can say, now you could have a living will that says, I want every possible thing to be done. That's true. But more often than not, the living will is a document to be mamayet tipulim instead of being marbet tipulim. That's a living will. Now, the power of attorney / healthcare proxy is different. It doesn't necessarily say what I want. But what it says is, in the event I am incapacitated, all decisions of what I want, and then you designate the shaliach, shall be made by, and you can mention here a rabbi, or you can mention a friend. Again, I'm not talking about halacha yet. Okay? So, theoretically, I can do a living will without designating somebody else to make decisions. Or I can do a healthcare proxy without designating specific hayrais. However, it is common that in an advanced directive, you actually say both things. You say what you want and what you don't want. But since you can't decide, you can't anticipate everything, you then designate a shaliach, a healthcare proxy, to make a decision. Now, the healthcare proxy can be, as they say, it can be a wife, can be a parent, it can be a brother, it can be a sister. Whoever it is, though, they are the bialim to make the decision. Right? Now, theoretically, they can't override your tzava in the living will. So, for example, legally we're talking about, if your living will said, I do not want dialysis in the event of kidney failure, but you also designated your wife to be your shaliach, you get incapacitated. And when you get incapacitated, your wife tells the hospital, put him on dialysis. Theoretically, the hospital is not supposed to listen because the shaliach, again, I'm using l'shaynis, halacha l'shaynis, although we're talking about secular law, but the logic is the shaliach has the koach only if he acts not keneged the tzava. Okay? So, however, practically, you should know, practically, the hospitals will usually listen because who's going to complain? I mean, basically, the guy's unconscious. He said he didn't want dialysis. The one that's alive, that's omid b'tzoveach, the wife says she wants dialysis. Now, legally, the hospital is supposed to follow the living will because those are the commands of the patient, and the shalichus is not mevatel the living will. But since this, theoretically, if he recovers, he could sue them. But, you know, they'll usually take, but what's going to happen? If he recovers, that's the problem. If he recovers, is he going to be upset that he's alive? Now, maybe so. If for example, he recovers, but he's in a very, very severely debilitated state. But usually, the hospital kind of hedges its bets. It basically says, well, listen, if the guy dies, he's not going to sue us. And if he gets better, he's not going to sue us. So we might as well go with the wife. Now, but again, legally, but if they would ask, if the hospital would ask their lawyer, what are we obligated to do? They say you are obligated to follow the living will, because the living will overrides the power of attorney. Because the power of attorney gives the shaliach authority only if it doesn't contradict what the living will says. So again, you can have a living will without power of attorney. You can have power of attorney without living will. You can have both. And collectively, all of these different documents are called advance directives. That's just the general rule. Under federal law, every patient admitted to a hospital at least has to be offered these documents. He may decide not to sign them. But even if you're going in for your tonsils or whatever it is, minor surgery, they have to give you these papers. And you look at it, and you can decide to sign it or not. Now, here is the thing. Agudas Yisrael of America prepared a document, and since every state, now the particular tsura of the document, the formalities, that depends on state to state. Sometimes there have to be witnesses, sometimes they don't have to be witnesses, sometimes they have to be notarized, sometimes they don't have to be notarized. So it's very, very important that one fills out the living will based on the state that they're in. Now, of course, that creates shilas when a person moves. Let's say a person executed a living will in Maryland, now they're in Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael, Israel has its own laws. But putting aside the issue of moving, there's something very important you need to know. Agudas Yisrael of America prepared a document that is called a halachic living will. And you can go to their, you can go to, I don't know if it has a website, but whatever, if you Google halachic living will, you'll be referred to a place that has all these things. And they prepared it for every state, all 50 states. In other words, Maryland halachic living will, a New York halachic living will. Again, 98% of the nusach is the same, but they just, make whatever little shinoyim are necessary. Now, halachic living will is really a total misnomer. They're using the wrong term. They should call it a halachic healthcare proxy. Because what the Aguda form says is the following. The Aguda form was written to guarantee that if you're a frum Jew, all medical decisions in the hospital or nursing home setting will be made al pi halacha and the hairas of a paisek. So it basically says this: in the Aguda living will, there's no living will at all. You don't say anything. You don't say, I want this, I don't want this. You basically say that if there is any question about treatments to be provided or not provided, I hereby direct the hospital, the doctors, the nursing home, the EMT, the ambulance to call Rabbi so-and-so. You pick your Rav, you give an address, you give a phone number, you give an email, if the rabbi has an email, and then you say even, and if he's not available, you know, somebody else. And all decisions have to be made based on the halachic determination. Now, that's correct. Only if he's incapacitated. That's correct. Because as long all of these documents only kick in when you're incapacitated. Because as long as you're awake, you know, you say who should, you know, you say, you ask the shalom, don't ask the shalom. You make the decision. Now, let me point out that this document is not saying that the rabbi is the agent. It actually says two things. It says, I hereby make my wife the agent, my child the agent, my father the agent, whatever it is. But it is my desire that all decisions be made in accordance with Orthodox Jewish law. And in the interpretation of Orthodox Jewish law, I am mechayev my agents. Yes, I misstated it a little bit. It's not mechayev the hospital. I am mechayev my agents to consult this Rav and to follow his psukim. And then it also says, in the event of an emergency where there's no time, I hereby direct my life needs to be... In other words, somebody goes into a heart attack and you don't have time to call the Rav, so the halachic living will says, keep me alive until you talk to the Rav, and then the next time it happens, you have a psak that will govern you one way or the other. So the halachic living will is essentially designed to create a situation where the tipulim, the medical decisions, will be made in accordance with halacha, by giving the medical people and by giving the family, by giving the agent a POSIC that you have to talk to. Now, obviously, you should talk to the POSIC ahead of time to be sure that, number one, he would be capable and willing to serve. And number two, this should be somebody that knows you. I mean, you shouldn't be like, you don't go to the Yellow Pages and pick a rabbi. This would be, in fact, one should talk to the Rav in terms of what is the Rav's approach, what is the Rav's mahalach. And I'll discuss what the, because again, the one thing the Aguda document doesn't do at all is if the Aguda document, you'd have no idea. You have no idea what the halacha is at. I mean, let's say I'm an Amoris. I don't know anything about, does halacha say I have to be kept alive? Does it say I don't have to be kept alive? Right? So I look at the Aguda living will. What do I learn from the Aguda living will about the halachas of when I have to be kept alive? I learn nothing at all, because all the document says is, if there's any questions, ask this Rav. But it doesn't educate me, right? So obviously, if you want to know about the sugya, because it's no get at you, you go to the Rav and you say, what are the halachas here? You see, it's the Aguda document, it's tayelas is not so that you should know what the halachas are. It basically says, when there's going to be a shayla, you know, this is the person that you trust to be machriya such a shayla. And these are serious shaylos. Not every rabbi, even a good rabbi, is capable of resolving such shaylos. And there, as you're going to see, there are going to be different approaches. But Aguda is very, very strong. They very much urge all from Yidden to do this. And this is important, especially important when a person has children who, Rahman al-Islam, are not religious. Because here's the thing. In some ways, if everybody's from, so no, you don't have to say ahead of time who's the posik. I mean, they have, you know, if the kids are B'nai Torah, they have poskim and they go to the poskim. But it's not so pashut, because kids may go to different poskim, and different poskim may pask in different ways. So even if the family are B'nai Torah, you're going to have problems. Chassidus HaPaiskim, again, I'm talking very generally, but you'll see shortly, Chassidus HaPaiskim and Machri on these Shailas, very different than Litvish HaPaiskim. But, so even in that case, it is Kedai to have a living will, so we have a POSEC that has to be consulted. What if the kids don't listen? What if the kids don't like your POSEC? Well, things break down L'maisa, because as I say, L'maisa, the hospitals will listen to the kids more than they'll listen to the living will directive, but okay. But it's especially important when a person has children that are not frum. Because let's say a person is a frum yid, and a person feels that al pi halacha, there should be aggressive life support, but under secular law, that's not so necessary, and the kids don't care about halacha. Or some kids care and some kids don't care. Right? But the living will, at least if it's followed, the halachic living, actually it's power of attorney, but what Aguda calls the halachic living will, basically says they cannot make decisions without getting a psak from this Rav. So it is very good. I mean, unfortunately, you know, there are many elderly people who have children, or some children who are not religious. And those children who are not religious are often very, very resistant to life support and the like for a variety of reasons. The halachic living will at least ensures that there'll be a necessary
psalm. Who's in possession of that halachic living will? The hospital?
So this is very important. So what do? You have a halachic living will. Where do you keep it? How does the hospital know? So a few things. So Aguda has a few recommendations. They first say they make a wallet-sized copy of it. So you actually have it in your wallet with your driver's license. So, you know, that when God forbid, a person's admitted to a hospital and becomes incapacitated, hospital staff is already trained to look in the wallet for some type of directive. And number two, since when you're admitted to the hospital, if assuming you're conscious, you'll be asked about living wills, you give it to them then. If you come in unconscious, then hopefully your family will give it to them. Of course, if the kids are not firm, you know, all sorts of things could happen. But you should give it to your doctor, your primary doctor. If one goes to the hospital, bring it to the hospital, and even carry a wallet-sized copy in your wallet. Okay, so this is, so Gouda has been pushing this for many, many years. Yes, there is. I would contact the Gouda in England for it. Maybe I can try to find out for you about it. But
yeah. Gouda in England?
Oh yeah, the Gouda is still in England, of course. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Gouda was very strong in England at one point. I think the founder of Agudas Yisrael was Rav Yaakov Rosenheim, who was a Yeti, a German. But I think after World War II, he emigrated to London. That's where he was. So that became a strong Agudas. In fact, Agudas in many ways is stronger in Europe than it is in the United States.
Today?
Well, today not so much. But
told me about this when I was...
But you understand the need for it. It's a useful thing to have. So,
What happens if they don't follow it? You can sue. Will that lawsuit?
So, in theory, you can sue. In other words, if your instructions were not followed, but again, if your instructions are not followed and you die,
the family members can sue.
The family can sue, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Does that work? Like, does that have a?
Yes, yes. The one thing about hospitals is that one of the things they are the most scared of in the world is being sued. Because a hospital, see, if a doctor is sued, you know, how much can you get from a doctor? And a hospital is sued, a hospital might pay, you know, $20 million. That's for one person, you know, so if a lot of people can sue a hospital, the hospital will go bankrupt. So hospitals will bend over backwards not to be sued. Yeah, so they'll be machmer on these in Yana because they don't want to be sued. Now, what happens sometimes is, there's a whole legal field here, sometimes if hospitals violated the living will, they'll destroy the document. In other words, if they have the only copy, you know, things will disappear in the system. You know, but then, if the jury finds out about that, there's something called punitive damages. You know, punitive damages is like knas, like arba v'chamisha. In other words, the keren is the damages. And then punitive is like a multiple of damages, which they only do if you really did something malicious, like destroy a document. So at that point, they make, you know, maybe $100 million, you know, may really, really go up in a phenomenal, phenomenal way. This happened, just to give you a mushroom of punitive damages. There used to be a car that Ford made in the 1960s. It was called the Pinto. Pinto was a little car, and the gas tank was situated in such a place that even if there was a little fender bender, a little thing, the car exploded. It was a very popular car, but it was a very dangerous car, and a lot of people got killed. So the families were suing. And that's fine. And, you know, so Ford had to pay a lot of money. But then they uncovered a memorandum that an engineer, Ford engineer, wrote, in which the engineer said the following. The engineer said, "This car is very dangerous, and we can be meshayer that over the next 10 years we're going to pay $100 million in nizakin. But since it would cost $200 million to change the design of the car," the engineer said, "it's kedai to keep it dangerous, even if 10,000 people are going to die, because that's cheaper than fixing." Now, that already was malicious, because essentially you're saying, you know, this is dangerous, you know it's going to kill people, but it's cheaper to kill people and pay their families than to fix the car. So that's called punitive damages. So instead of paying $100 million, they paid like $600 million. Oh. So it no longer became cheaper. It would have been cheaper to fix that. So that's mamash a kenas. Okay. So because of this, hospitals try hard not to get sued. In fact, that's a whole phenomenon. I mean, I don't want to get into healthcare economics. The reason why, more in the United States than in Israel, the reason why healthcare is so expensive and even insurance is expensive is that hospitals are often ordering test after test after test after test after test after test, all sorts of unnecessary testing, because they need to be 100% sure that you have yet whatever sickness it is, because otherwise they can get sued for a wrong diagnosis. So that's really increasing the whole cost of everything, because they're going overboard not to be sued. That's called defensive medicine, and that adds a lot of money to healthcare costs. Okay. So be it as it may, I'll try to find out what you have in England. I think I'll send you an email. This is called Halachic Living Will, Aguda. And as I say, living will is a tois, it should be halachic proxy or halachic power of attorney, but this is what Aguda pushes. Now, it's interesting that the OU, which is kind of the modern Orthodox group, did a living will of their own, but it's come out, it's a bubble, people don't use it at all. And it was really predicated on a very different concept than Aguda. The OU was actually a living will, in which it said, you can check, do I want dialysis, don't I want dialysis, do I want CPR, that's chest pounding, or don't I want CPR? Because the nafkamina was like this, the OU was following Rav Moshe Tendler as a paisik, as opposed to Aguda, which didn't follow any paisik. Aguda just said, ask your paisik. The OU followed Rav Moshe Tendler. Rav Moshe Tendler has a shita, we'll see, that the patient has the right not to be marech chayim if he's incapacitated and the like. So the OU actually spelled out choices you can make, including the choice to even be an organ donor. Again, Rav Moshe Tendler Lishitasai, that we did talk about, who allows organ donation and the like. So the OU is a much more, the OU living will is a much more directive document, meaning it actually spells out decision making, although it does have a rabbinic override. In other words, it's interesting. To cover themselves, they said, this is what I want. But then it said, but if my posek, Rabbi so-and-so, says no, his decision should override what I just said.
But do they have to contact that or not?
Well, it's not clear. I have to look at how it was worded, you know. And of course, you can cross anything out you want anyway. But the Aguda decided, I'm not sure if there was a discussion on this, that they didn't want to even put the options in. They just said every shaila goes to the paisek, and that's going to be Mahriya. Okay? So that's the first thing you need to know. Now, let me point out that legally for a moment, a living will is so binding that not only does a patient have the right to say, I don't want dialysis, I don't want chemotherapy, etc., he could even say, I don't want hydration and nutrition. Hydration is water, and nutrition is food. Meaning to say that the right to decline medical treatments includes the right, legally, to starve to death. You have the right to decline food. Which we're going to see, according to halacha, that's a very, very serious question. But the Supreme Court of the United States has taken the position that food and water is like any other medical treatment, and the patient is a bal habas to say, I do not want it. And certainly if he's incapacitated, unless he could say ahead of time that I don't want artificial feeding, intravenous, tube feeding, right? These are different types of ways. You know, there's a tube in the nose, and there's a tube in a gastro tube in the stomach, right? These are different ways that people are fed nutrition, intravenous lines. It used to be that doctors took the position that nutrition was not medicine, nutrition was not surgery, nutrition was not chemotherapy. Nutrition we have to give. How do we allow a person to starve? That is not true anymore under American law, and even under Israeli law, the same thing. Hydration and nutrition, which are fancy terms for food and water, are treated like any other medical treatment. So a patient in a living will can either, the patient can say, give it to me, or the patient can say, don't give it to me, and it won't be given.
Israeli law, they take a more secular approach.
Yes, Israeli law is essentially a secular law. Unless you do a document. Now, you can do a document like Aguda that says the posek will be machriya. But in terms of the Israeli law is a secular law.
Does it apply to all hospitals?
It applies to all hospitals.
Some hospitals which follow halacha, like Laniado.
Well, it applies to all hospitals, but again, you know, the Laniato and the like will, well, we'll discuss what happens if the patient has given a directive that contradicts what Halacha says. What do you do? Okay, well, we'll talk about that. But Israel does not make an exception. Remember, the state of Israel, you know, for all its good, is a secular state, although religious parties have a certain amount of power in the secular state. But these things are largely secular, right? These things are secular laws, and they are binding on even religious hospitals. Religious hospitals have to obey these secular laws. Okay.
I once heard, I don't think it's true, that there was such a thing that Israel wasn't allowed to pass a law that's the first connected halacha. Was there such a thing?
I'm not aware of it. I'm really not aware of it.
Doesn't look like it.
I don't think so. The only law that they have in Israel is this. It says if the Knesset has not passed a law, then the judges are supposed to try to apply halacha.
Really?
In other words, because it used to be that what judges were doing, if there was no law of the Knesset, they were looking to British law, they were looking to American law, they were looking to international law. In other words, because there was no precedent. If there was no precedent, they were looking to everything except Jewish law. So the Knesset did pass a law that if we don't say fakeret, you go buster halacha.
Well, when was this law passed?
No. This was a long time ago. This was passed like in the 80s or 70s.
They go by this?
Yeah, they go. In other words, when the Knesset doesn't have a law. Yeah, but the Knesset tends to have laws for almost everything. In other words, it's kind of a nod to Judaism, meaning since it's a Jewish state, so if the Knesset doesn't go for keret, you know, you might as well follow halacha. But the Knesset goes for keret all the time, you know, so it's not much of a thing, but you know, it's a nod. At least it's saying we're machshiv halacha more than we're machshiv, you know, British law, mandatory law, Turkish law. They're looking at Ottoman law, you know, from whatever it was. You know, why should Ottoman law like be a precedent? There's not even an Ottoman Empire anymore, because you know, because Israel had all of these different secular laws. You know, so yeah, he looks at halacha. Okay. All right, so now let me just discuss some of the halachic issues here. Again, Stan, what does halacha say? What do you have to do for a sick person? So first of all, we know like this. We know, let's start with one thing that's absolutely usher, and even that is a bit of a machlokes. Even in secular law, there is one thing that in most places you're not allowed to do, and that is, you cannot actively kill a patient, bekum v'yase. So, yes, the patient has the right to say no chemotherapy, no dialysis, no CPR, and even has the right to say no food and water, even though we would look at that as suicide. But the patient cannot say, kill me. The patient cannot say, inject me with poison. The patient cannot say, hook me up to an electric chair and kill me. Because that is murder, mitzad the doctor, and that is suicide, mitzad the patient. And secular law does say that you cannot actively kill somebody even if they desire to be killed. So already this introduces an important distinction in secular law between actively terminating life and passively, shevi al tasa, withholding things that keep you alive. Right? This is a very important distinction. Active versus passive. You're going to see in halacha this is also going to be important in some ways. Now, let me point out that although what I said, b'derech klal, is true, it is not true everywhere. There are some places in the world that legally legitimate a physician helping a patient commit suicide. Not just, don't give me CPR. Kill me. Give me something that will kill me. There are countries that say that is okay, if that's what the patient wants. This is the law in the Netherlands. This is the law in Sweden. In the United States, this is the law in Oregon and Washington, in the United States. And this is recently the law in Canada. Now, I don't mean to say it's not as broad as I'm saying. It doesn't mean any guy walks in off the street and says, "Hey, doctor, kill me. I just can't stand this in my job anymore." I mean, there are conditions. You have to like give him three. It's like asking a chazan. You have to ask him three times. There's a waiting period because maybe he's temporarily depressed, etc. So they're different, and there are gavulim. I don't want to say it's as porous as I'm.
Can a friend also aid a person in hanging himself?
No, it's a special rule. Doctor can assist. Doctor can assist. But achar kol amaisim, there are some places that actually say, "Not this is autonomy run amok." That your bilis is not only a bilis. Say, "I don't want an operation." Your bilis is, kill me. And that even patters the doctor. It's not only suicide, it patters ritzicha. Now, most states, most countries do not allow this. And they say such a doctor could be tried as a murderer. But there is a movement. This movement is growing, by the way.
What's it called?
It's called physician-assisted suicide. Sometimes abbreviated PAD. The movement is growing, and one can anticipate more and more states and countries are going to jump on this, and especially Canada. Canada is a civilized country. Canada actually said, in fact, Canada did it in a very unusual way. Canada did not even have a law that allowed it. The Supreme Court of Canada said, "You're mechuyev to have such a law." They didn't just say, "You're allowed." In other words, they said to the provinces, they didn't just say, "You're allowed to have such a law." They said, "Fakert, if you assert the suicide, you're violating the person's constitutional rights." That's much different, right? They actually created a chiyuv. This is Supreme Court of Canada, a chiyuv to permit or to enable suicide. Now, in the United States Supreme Court, it was very interesting. The United States Supreme Court said, on the identical issue, there is no chiyuv to allow it. The Supreme Court said a state has reshus to allow it, and only two states did. But a state is not mechuyev to allow it. That's bad enough. Canada said the individual provinces are mechuyev to allow it, because if a state were to say a doctor cannot help a patient commit suicide, that would be a violation of the patient's rights. So this is autonomy run amok. This is autonomy going to the furthest degree. Now, there's going to be a whole lot of questions here, because this gets worse and worse and worse. So now you tell me the patient can tell the doctor, "Help me die." What if the patient's in a coma? Can the family say, "Oh, there's an anansari, the patient would want to die, doctor, so kill him"? It's going to go weiter and weiter and weiter, starting with the patient, and then you'll end with people saying, "He's not worth living anyway, so he's not worth it." It's all of these things. Okay, but be it as it may, let's go over the halachas of suicide for a moment. It's generally nemdan, of course. A suicide is called a ma'abed atzmai ladas, and a ma'abed atzmai ladas, it says in Maseches Semachos, ein lo chelek li'aylam haba. Obviously, there's no misa spasten because he killed himself. But he's called a rotzeach. In fact, one might ask the interesting question. In fact, let me ask you an interesting question. Maseches Semachos says, if you commit suicide, you don't have a share in aylam haba. But l'chayra, is suicide worse than ritzicha? I mean, if Reuven is rotzeach Shimon, again, it's your fellow Chaveira. But Lamaisa, Ritzicha is not one of the Averas. I mean, of course, there'll be Gehenim, but it's not one of the Averas that you're Mafsid Eilam Haba. So, why would suicide be Ein Loi Chelek Leilam Haba if Ritzicha is Yesh Loi Chelek Leilam Haba? In other words, I wouldn't think suicide is worse than murder. We would say suicide is murder. You're murdering yourself. So someone will learn this way. Someone will learn that the problem with suicide is that the person didn't do tshuva before he died. Bishlama, when Reuven kills Shimon. So we're taila that Reuven, when he eventually dies, is a chayzer b'tshuva on his ritzicha of Shimon, and the mele he'll be a ben olam haba. But if the aver is killing yourself, then maybe it's not gemol tshuva. Although the emes says sometimes a person has, you know, there was a doctor, and now he's in jail. I think he's still in jail. Kevorkian. Do you ever hear of Jack Kevorkian? Jack Kevorkian was a Michigan doctor, and he invented a suicide machine, which was really a gas, like exhaust gas, in which patients would put a mask on, and he would turn on the machine. It was like putting your, you know, hooking up to the exhaust pipe on an automobile, and people would die. And he, and you know, these were terminally ill people who were suffering, etc. He helped them. He was the one. And he went to jail for this because he was doing this in Michigan where it was against the law. And I think he may, of course, he may still be in jail. But one of the things they said was that patients, once they're in the machine and they begin dying, they were begging him to stop. But he couldn't. I mean, the process couldn't be stopped at that point. Mm-hmm. I mean, he could shut off the machine, but that wouldn't revive the patient. This is Nazis. This is what the Nazis did. This is the gas chambers of the Nazis, and Kevorkian was doing this. But one might say that according to Maseches Semacha, Ma'abed Atzmi L'Das, the problem is what? The problem is that he didn't do tshuva. Okay.
I would say it's Mida Yeah. Kevorkian.
Yeah, what?
Just like someone's care for Mitzchias Arisen.
Yeah.
Is it really that bad on everybody? He doesn't believe in us. He doesn't get it. So this person says that he's not interested. Not interested in his life, so he doesn't get whatever life
meant. I hear. In other words, he's making a statement about himself. I hear. Now, Maseches Semacha says another thing too. It says, "Ma'abed asmi ladas." There is no avelus. The mishpacha doesn't sit shiva. There is no kriya. Right? No avelus. Ma'abed asmi ladas. But here, the paiskim bring from the Sefer Chassidim, but it's brought down in the Shach. It's brought down by all of the paiskim. A very interesting rule. Actually, I think even Maseches Semacha says this rule, that the rule that a ma'abed asmi ladas does not have a share in olam haba and does not have avelus is only if he did it b'daitai tzalula. His mind was clear, he was not depressed, he was not sabrachin. He just decided he wanted to die. So memela, that's it. But a person who commits suicide because of tiruf hadas, extreme depression, so in Aman he was like a temporary shaita, and b'chi ha'gavne we do sit shiva and say kaddish, and then the achrayim say it's a catch 22 that since a person who died tzlula wouldn't commit suicide, so you neman that he did it b'toich tiruf hadas. Now, there's the bottom line is, now, there's, if you're a Rav, again, I myself have had cases. If you're a Rav, and someone in your congregant's mishpacha or your congregant commits suicide, the bottom line is, the minog is, we do say Kaddish, and we do Kriya, we do Avelis, because we neman that it's b'toich tiruf hadas. I'll get to that. That's a totally different issue. That's an issue. We'll talk about that. But you're right. Chana, yeah. No, the Shiva Bana died on Kiddush Hashem. But the issue is Chana jumping off the roof. That's correct. That would be an example of Tiruf Hadas. But we'll talk about that. That would be a primary example. But the Kiddush of the Achrayim, which is not in Maseches Semacha, is that you neman every suicide is Tiruf Hadas. This is what they used to say. This is how lawyers got the mass murderers off. You know, a guy goes around killing, you know, 50 people. So they get him off on insanity. How do they get him off? Says, well, no normal person would kill 50 persons. He must have been crazy. All right. Yeah, but obviously that can't be the case, because obviously otherwise nobody could ever be nanas for Ritzicha. Well, there might be cases of people who are not Tiruf Hadas, people who write these suicide notes and they plan for 3 months exactly how to do it. Everything is prate pratim. And it's interesting that a lot of suicides, it's very fascinating. Literature of suicide is very interesting. A lot of people try suicide, the people who try suicides, they're doing it to get attention. In other words, they actually don't want to die. They want someone to realize how depressed they are, how sad they are, and then somebody will take care of them. There was a famous, just a little mice, there was a famous British poet, Sylvia Plath, who was always, you know, attempting suicide and this and that, and getting rescued, and her stomach would be pumped, you know. It was a way of getting attention in a very desperate way. That she was a very very gifted person, but a very, very depressed person. So the story goes that, I mean, this isn't even terminal illness, this is just like depression and the like. So she took like a bottle of sleeping pills, which is one of the ways people kill themselves. And she was found by her cleaning lady 5 hours later, dead. But here is the chat. The cleaning lady was supposed to come 1 hour after Sylvia Plath took the pills. So let's say Sylvia Plath took the pills at 10 a.m. The cleaning lady was supposed to come 11 a.m. And Sylvia Plath expected that. And had the cleaning lady showed up at 11 a.m., she would have been taken to the hospital and her stomach would have been pumped and she would have been okay. Elamai, the cleaning lady, called at 10:45 when Sylvia Plath was already unconscious, that she won't be able to come till 2 or 3. So she shows up 2 or 3, Sylvia Plath is dead. You see, so Sylvia Plath didn't even have kavana to take her life, but this cleaning lady showed up a few hours late. Right? Well, these are serious games, right? These are serious games. Is Sylvia Plath a Ma'amid Asma Lodas? It's not clear. On one hand, she didn't have kavana to kill herself. On the other hand, she's playing games. You're playing games. What do? I mean, you jump into a lion's den to see if you're going to be Daniel or not. You know, I mean, you get killed. You know, that's Ma'amid Asma Lodas. In fact, they tell a maestro of Yaakov Kamenetsky, this is a very stark maestro, but it could only be Lemigdar Milsa, where there was a chayla, a very firm person. He was a chayla. And Rav Yaakov Paskins, he had to eat on Yom Kippur. And the Chayla said, I have never broken Yom Kippur. I'm going to fast. He fasted, and he died from it. Wow. Rav Yaakov Paskins, the family should not sit Shiva.
Wow.
Rav Yaakov said, he is a Ma'abed Asmoy Ladas, because the Halacha said he was Mechayiv to eat. I have a feeling that may not be Al Pi Din. That may just be to make your mill so that people should understand that this is a Psak Tid on Yom Kippur is a Chi of Gomer. Because once again, he didn't intend to kill himself, but the Pshia was so great, so Sylvia Plath might fall under the same getter. I'll tell you another Maisa, Ma'amid Asmei Lodas. This happened in Eretz Yisrael, I think it happened in Eretz Yisrael, around 20 years ago, that a woman comes into a hotel, and she wants to rent a room for the day, and she says she prefers a high floor. So they figured, no, she likes the view, whatever it is. And the hotel told her that there is no room available till 5 in the afternoon. She shows up 10 in the morning. Says, 5 in the afternoon, there'll be a room. So she's in the hotel lobby 7 hours. 7 hours. 5 o'clock, she gets a room. She checks in, and she throws herself out of the window. She died. She committed suicide. But here's what people say. People, Achar HaMaisa, reconstructed the following. She was sitting in a hotel lobby for 7 hours. Nobody spoke to her at all. Nobody spoke to her. You see, I mean, I'm not saying men should do it, but no, a woman is by herself. No woman approached her. Nobody spoke to her. What would have been? Somebody would give her a friendly word. You know, you never know. You see a stranger. I'm not saying men should approach women, but whatever. Women to women, men to men, whatever it would be. Now you see a person, they're by themselves. Yeah, you think mabukach, you know, well, why do I have to get involved in somebody else? You never know the difference that a friendly word can make. If somebody would have spoken to her a friendly word. You know, it could have changed everything. Achar HaMaisa, people were saying, Achar HaMaisa. You see what it means to open up to somebody, to give them Shalom Aleichem, how are you, what's going on. You could mamish be pikuach nefesh gomer. So it's a, it's a musr to be mispaine in these inyanim. In fact, they even have a play. So it's a funny play. A guy is about to commit suicide, and he gets a phone call. The phone rings, and he's a bit of an obsessive compulsive, so he's going to answer the phone before he takes care of himself. And it's a woman who calls, and it's a wrong number. But he kind of says to her something like, you know, please don't bother me, I'm trying to kill myself, just, you know, get up. And like, she keeps on calling back, and she talks him out of it. I think he probably got it from it was a famous play. He probably borrowed it from the play. Okay. But Peseder. So now the emes is so we can generally say suicide is forbidden, right? That's the general rule. Einochinami, if it's tiruf hadas, we don't punish you for it because, you know, you weren't in your right mind. But even if you were a shaita, that doesn't make it mutter. That just says achar hamaisa, we're not going to, or the Eibishter is not going to condemn you for it. But the problem is, we do have a few cases of suicide, both in Tanakh and in Chazal.
Shaul Yedison.
That's correct. One case is a little earlier, is Shimshon, although we'll be mechalek. Right, remember Shimshon is blind, and he's at the big mishteh of the Plishtim, and he asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu to give him strength. And what does Shimshon say? The famous phrase, "Tamos nafshi in Plishtim, I will die with the Plishtim." Zachreina, a lot of people are against that song. That song is violent. Zachreina,
Chaskeina.
Yeah,
was it illegal outposts of the week?
Yeah.
With all these people,
right?
And a friend of mine asked them, like, "What do you say about the doom of murder?"
Right.
And they all started screaming. He's like, "Ready now, ready now."
Right. Yeah. So there's something to be said about that. Yeah. So anyway. But Shimshon actually killed himself, right? Shimshon killed himself. Okay, well, obviously Yesh L'Chalek, because Shimshon killed himself as a way of killing the right fim of Klal Yisrael. Okay, the second example is Shaul HaMelech, right? Now here there's a stira. At the end of Sefer Shmuel Aleph, Shaul was pierced by the enemies, and he asks his arms bearer, the one that would hold his sword, "Finish me off, so I shouldn't fall in the hands of the Plishtims." The arms bearer refused to do it, so the pasuk says Shaul took his sword and he killed himself. That's what the pasuk says. Now, the emes is, it's very, very interesting, that in the beginning of Shmuel Beis, the next sefer, there's actually a stira. It's a stira. The Rishonim ask the stira, because the end of Shmuel Aleph, Shaul kills himself. Now, if you remember, the beginning of Shmuel Beis, David HaMelech has now become officially the king. And a ger Amaleki. Now what on earth is a ger Amaleki? An Amalekite who became a ger. How can an Amalekite become a ger? He's supposed to kill Amaleki. But a ger Amaleki goes to David. And he thinks David's going to be real happy that Shaul is dead. And he says, "I'm the one. I saw Shaul dying, and I'm the one that took the sword and finished him off." And David HaMelech said, "You killed the Mashiach Hashem. For that I kill you." So, Bichlal, there's a stira. The end of Shmuel Aleph describes Shaul as a suicide. The beginning of Shmuel Beis describes Shaul as being killed. I mean, he was already a geisus by virtue of the Polishnim, but the actual Ritzicha was done by this very strange hybrid called Ger Amaleki. So the Rishonim give different answers. The Radak, the Rishonim ask the Kasha that there's a stira in the story. Most learned that Shaul indeed killed himself. The Ger Amaleki was lying. And although David said, "Oh, you killed Mashiach Hashem," David really killed him because he was Mizera Amalek. Mm-hmm. You know, they go into that and the like. Because first of all, how can you kill the guy? I mean, David couldn't have killed him because he said, "I killed Shaul." Even if he did kill Shaul, that's all of Eino Demesim Asmei Rasha. In other words, if I come in and I say, "I killed somebody," I'm not Neman. And of course, you have to have a Sanhedrin of Chav Gimel. So, but the emphasis is David may have acted out of Mishpat HaMelech, that you don't need a Sanhedrin. again, I mean, you could give terutzim to all of these things. That when do you need Edim and Hasra and a Sanhedrin of Chav Gimel? That's when the Melech is not paskening Mishpat Hamlucha. But the Melech can kill Al Piyumdin. Okay. But assuming, as the Radak learns, that the account in Shmuel Aleph is the Messias, that Shaul killed himself, don't we have a problem that Shaul committed suicide? Right, so how do you fanfare? Say again? He might be a geisus. Can a geisus commit suicide? L'chayra not, because it's brought, the Gemara says, again, Maseches Smachos, that you're not allowed to touch a geisus, because you're going to be geirim yitzias haneshama. So there is an issur d'oraisa. You're chayav misa for killing a geisus. So l'chayra, if you're chayav misa for killing a geisus, the issur of suicide is going to apply to a geisus. So there are a few terutzim that we give for Shaul, that the Rishonim give. Some say, all right, who says Shaul acted al pi din? I mean, Shaul was a great, great tzaddik, but there were a number of things where Shaul did not act al pi din, such as not killing Agag. So this, you know, you can't bring a riot from Shaul. This may have been another avla that Shaul killed himself, Shaloi al pi din, which is one possibility.
Because the Gidin got in trouble for not getting a proper hesped.
That's a good raya.
That says that he died like a teenage vendor.
Yeah. Those are both good rayas, because you're correct. If Shaul is a ma'abed asmei ladas, Mimela, we wouldn't be maspidim. Although you could say maybe he killed al stiruf hadas, right? In other words, he, not that it's mutter, but he was a maturif. Okay. Another teretz is this. Another teretz is the following idea, that Shaul was afraid that the Pelishtim would capture him and they would torture him. They would torture him and mock him. Now, here is the Nakuda. Can you commit suicide to avoid torture? So some say yes, because the Gemara says by Chananya, Mishael, and Azariah. Chananya, Mishael, and Azariah, when Nebuchadnezzar said, be mishtachaveh to the tzelem, or I'll throw you into a kifshin o'esh. So Chananya, Mishael, and Azariah were mekadesh shem shemayim, and they were willing to die, which is the din, rather than worship Avodah Zarah. But the Gemara says in Ksuvos that if Chananya, Mishael, and Azariah would have been tortured, they would have been mishtachaveh to tzelem. Because torture is even worse than death. And if torture is worse than death, some say you are allowed to even kill yourself in order to avoid extreme torture. That's a second mahalach. We'll go over each of these more barichas later. I just want to mention the terutzim, then we're going to stop. The third teretz is like this. The third teretz is, it's torture, but it's adding another haysafa. That Shaul was afraid not only that they would torture him, but they would torture him to be Oved Avodah Zarah. And here is the Kenech. We know that in order not to be Oved Avodah Zarah, Yehareg V'al Yavor. So they want to learn this way. This is the Das HaKena Mibalei Yataisus in Parshas Noach. Big Chiddush. Keshem that you must give your life to avoid worshipping Avodah Zarah, you are allowed to take your life to avoid worshipping Avodah Zarah. That's a big chiddush, meaning the din of Mesiras Nefesh doesn't only mean let the goy kill me, but you can kill yourself. And not only can you kill yourself, but the Das HaKeinim brings a horrendous maisa that you can even kill other people. These were situations, and these were Maisim Shahaya, that during the Crusades, Christians surrounded the city, and they said, you worship Avodah Zarah, we'll kill you, we'll torture you, till we break you. There were certain kehilas, where parents killed their children, and then killed themselves. This is actually one of the keynotes of Tisha B'Av. So the Shaul precedent was He killed himself because he was afraid he would be tortured into worshipping Avodah Zarah. And this is going with the Hanacha that you're allowed to take your life in order not to be Oiver on the Gimel Chamures. And now the final answer, I'll give you the final answer of the Shoal suicide.
So the children that drown themselves.
Children drown themselves, that would be similar, that's right. Gemara in Gittin has stories about women drowning themselves in order to avoid Arayos. Some say there was a similar Holocaust story, although some say that was a false, didn't happen. You know, there was a long story that was for many years. People said a story about 400 Beis Yaakov girls committed suicide because they were afraid that they would be raped or forced into Zunus by the Nazis. And this would fall al pi the din that for the Gimel Chamurais, you could take your life. But I think they said that story didn't happen. That actually did not happen, although people still tell that story. Okay. But there is a, but again, the Gemara in Gittin gives a very similar story of boys and girls jumping off the boat because they were taken the Kalein, they were taken to, you know, shameful arayas. Now, the last teretz is like this. If you think about it, every time a soldier goes to war and he's putting his life in danger, you know, why don't you treat it like a ma'amid asmu l'das? But the answer is that he's putting himself in danger to be matzil, Klal Yisrael. So Shaul felt if he would be tortured in front of the Jewish people, that would have such a devastating effect on the morale of the nation, that they would be defeated, that he took his life in the same way that a soldier gives his life in order to be matzil. Right, so we have a few mahalfim. Either Shaul acted out of tiraf hadas, so it was shaloka halacha, but he's not an achroi, which would still allow him to have a hesped, and he would still be below chay. The second is he took his life to avoid torture. The third is he took his life so he wouldn't be forced to be oved avodah zarah, which are the gimel chamuras. And the fourth answer is he took his life in order that he shouldn't devastate the morale of the Jewish army, and therefore this was an act of hatzalah. The same way a soldier is machzis himself in sakana to be matzil, so Shaul's death was an indirect hatzalah by not allowing him to be tortured in that way. Okay, but we'll provide you next week with this. Okay, take care.